Well, welcome, Dr. Jones. I heard you on Red Ice Creations. I heard an interview that you gave, and I was absolutely fascinated by your work and by your research, and what you've uncovered about what I see, Dr. Jones, and I've seen it for years now on the media. It's just a degradation of our culture. I mean, the programming is hideous. It's sex, it's violence, it's even the sitcoms are all kind of smarmy now. And it didn't used to be that way. I mean, I can remember, you know, even like the Bill Cosby show and the Mary Tyler Moore show and Carol Burnett show. These were all wonderful shows that I could share with my children. And now it's hideous. You've done research. Perhaps you could shed some light on what has happened to our culture regarding what the media is doing to us.
Yeah, well, it's a long story, and I've been researching the story for 35 years now. That's when I started Culture Wars magazine. But the key to understanding the sexualization of our culture is that sexual liberation is a form of control. That's most people don't understand that. They perceive it as a kind of freedom, freedom to act on your desires. But there's a long history of people who understand how they can use this to control people. I mean, you said in the beginning that we're talking about our nature as human beings. Our nature is to be rational. It's to be reasonable creatures, to recognize the order of the universe as created by God. That order, the Greeks gave a name for that order. They called it logos. Logos is translated as speech. Actually, if you go into – the reason I have to use this when I'm talking about it is that there are basically five pages of English words in a Greek-English dictionary that can be used for it. And to say that it's word – is simply reducing it to something that makes it, for most people, incomprehensible. It's rationality, it's the order of the universe, it's the mind of God. It's all of these things all wrapped up in one. And that's the nature of what we are. But we've been created with passions or appetites, and these are necessary to survive. But in order to keep them in proportion or where they belong, they have to be subjected to reason. Now, everybody understands this when it comes to something like the appetite for food. Everybody knows that if you eat too much, you're going to get fat. And if you get fat, you're not going to be healthy. Or if you drink too much, you're going to get drunk. And if you get behind the wheel, you're going to kill yourself or hurt somebody. But it's harder to understand with sex for some reason or other, because it's such an insistent desire. And there are people who understood that if you promote this, you cloud people's understanding. The scholastic philosophers like St. Thomas Aquinas would say, lust darkens the mind. That's his way of understanding it. It can eclipse reason. And these people who were understanding this, and I'm talking about some like the beginning with someone like the Marquis de Sade during the French Revolution, all the way up to Wilhelm Reich, the Freudian communist, wrote during the 1930s, they realized if you increase these passions, you can manipulate people and get them to do what you want to do. So it became a form of control. And so at the same time, Reich was studying Sigmund Freud. Sigmund Freud was using these insights to control people, in a sense, rich Americans, so he could get money from them. His nephew was Eddie Bernays, and he's the father of public relations and advertising. And people began to realize you could use this to control people. And that's, in a sense, the history of what we're talking about. The history of the sexualization of our culture is really the people who control the culture, let's call them the oligarchs, have discovered that this is a very effective way to bring people under control. And so they control the media, they control what we see, what we think, and they control it for their interest, not for our interest.
Well, and if we're all focused on sex, we're not paying attention to what's going on behind the wizard, are we? We're not.
That's right. No, you actually, you hit the nail right on the head there. That's exactly the point of all of this. I'll give you a recent example of this. Hillary Clinton is running for president, and she said, even if we broke up the big banks, we still have racism and sexism. Well, what she's really saying there is that the oligarchs spend a lot of money to get someone like me elected president so that I can distract everyone with this talk about sex and race so that no one will bother them, so that they can live their lives unmolested by the great majority of people. We are going through a crisis right now. Right now in this election cycle, also a crisis in terms of representative government in the United States. The oligarchs are drunk with power. Let's stop for a minute. Who are the oligarchs now in terms of what we're talking about right now? If you look at a state like Indiana, last year they passed something called the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, which was to protect little people who own bakeries from being forced to bake cakes for gay weddings, something like that. It was a reaction to all of this push that came for homosexual marriage. Well, this unleashed a huge hue and cry, a huge campaign demonizing Indiana as backward and discriminatory and so on and so forth. Well, there's a cabal of CEOs and homosexuals who land in the state and threaten the government. They actually, and not only did they threaten it, they overthrew state government in the state of Indiana and basically forced the governor to backtrack and basically retract the law that they had passed. Now, this raises an interesting constitutional issue. Who's the ruler here? Do the people of Indiana get to elect representatives and they get to make laws, or do they only get to make laws that are pleasing to the oligarchs, to the CEO of the CEOs and their homosexual proxy warriors? That's the battle that's being fought right now in North Carolina.
Yeah.
Georgia caved in immediately after the NFL got involved, and Mississippi. Because right now, I think that the oligarchs, I said they're drunk with power, and they perceive state government as the weak link. And they basically can take over state government and enforce their rule on the people of these states.
We've talked about that, Dr. Jones, and you may not be aware of it, but the network that we're calling government is really a vast network of corporate control coming from the federal corporation, and they do it at pretty much, you're pretty much describing the end result. They do it by offering grants to these different states, and the different agencies within the states take the money, and basically the elected officials are kind of left in the wings because policies start being implemented that they knew nothing about and they didn't even vote for.
Right. Well, I mean, let's face it, state government has been on the defensive ever since the Civil War.
Yes.
Especially vis-a-vis the Supreme Court and the federal government. But this is a new intrusion into state government. These are not government actors. These are private corporations, private individuals who just now can come in and basically say, no, you've got to change the law. I mean, who is this guy? He's from San Francisco. He's not from Indiana. No one elected him. And yet he now has the power to tell the legislators in Indiana, Georgia, North Carolina, Mississippi, who knows where it's going to be next, that you've got to change your laws to come in line with what we want. This is a total, what we're seeing here is an assault on representative government. And it all goes back to what I just said about sexual liberation. The homosexual now is the avant-garde of the sexual revolution.
Well, you know, you're speaking about Ed Bernays, the father of propaganda and all of that. What I found was interesting is how, you know, like a century ago, there's a wonderful documentary called Human Resources. And a century ago, the robber barons figured out that if they could control the workplace, and do everything they could to diminish the empowerment that the workers felt, okay, make their jobs pretty tedious and unpleasant, as long as they did that, when they go home at night, They would seek entertainment. They would not seek to change the system. In other words, the whole thing was designed to make the people sort of downtrodden. And by doing that, they were too tired to go to meetings. They were too tired to get involved. And they lost their sense of empowerment. And I think what you're describing with the whole sexual revolution, just another stab at unempowering the population so that the robber barons can do whatever they want.
I think you're right. I think you're right. And I think that one of the crucial decade, I think, in this regard was the 1970s. And so it began with sexual liberation. Roe versus Wade was 1973. Feminism was the vehicle of sexual liberation at that point. And it ended with the deregulation of usury. And I think that's the 1-2 punch about that. That's how the oligarchs, that's how they create their system of control.
Yes.
It's now been imposed on all of the new countries that came into the European Union. I was in Poland. I did a book tour there, and just at the time when the Catholic bishops issued their statement on gender ideology, finally there's a group of people that's starting to wake up to the fact that this sexualization of your culture, it doesn't happen by accident. There's a plan here, and the plan is control. It's very simple. So you derange a group of people. Let's take the worker. Beginning of the 1970s, he's doing as well as he's ever done in the United States.
Yes.
I mean, this is an anti-labor country. After World War II, the Detroit, the big three, Ford in particular, made peace with the UAW. There was an era of prosperity, unprecedented prosperity after World War I. It ended in 73. That's when wages started going up. That's when sexual liberation started to kick in. And by the end of the decade, we had Paul Volcker coming in as head of the Fed, and we had everything reversed. The entire system was basically overturned, and we had the system of usury imposed on the country. Suddenly, the creditors were now back in power. Creditors are always a minority. They are an essential part of the oligarchs that I'm talking about, probably the most crucial part.
Yes.
Of the 1% that we described at Occupy Wall Street, you know, the protest against the 1%. These are all so who are the oligarchs? Okay, it's always going to be some type of minority group. Creditors, CEOs, homosexuals, and Jews. These are the crucial elements that make up this oligarchic group of people that is now drunk with power and basically trying to deprive the entire country of representative government.
Yes, I totally agree. And what's interesting, and I did post on anticorruptionsociety.com, oh gosh, I think it was 2 years ago, a really well-written article about usury. And this researcher, I think probably the listeners are aware that the Muslims are opposed to usury. And Dr. Jones, I know you've done research in Catholicism. The author of that article intimated, or actually stated, that at one time the Catholic Church or the Christians were opposed to usury, and there truly is a story in the Bible about Jesus throwing out the money monsters. So how is it that the Catholic Church is now silent on the topic of usury?
All right, this happened, the last official statement on the Catholic Church on usury is 1745. It's an encyclical called Vix Pervenit. This is the official teaching of the Catholic Church. The Catholic Church can never rescind the prohibition on usury any more than it can rescind the Ten Commandments. It can't do that. It doesn't have that commission. It can only proclaim the Word of God. It can't correct the Word of God. Okay? So usury is a sin. It's still a sin. It never stopped being a sin. Now, what happened over this period of time, let's say as of 1745, the economic situation got more complicated. It got complicated beginning at the end of the Middle Ages, when Europe switched from a basically labor economy where you owed a certain number of days to your lord, to a time where you had to pay taxes in money. And so there was a moment here, let's say in Italy at the end of the 15th century, where suddenly there was a demand for money that didn't exist. Money was money was limited to pieces of gold and silver.
Right.
And there's never enough gold and silver to go around to satisfy the productivity of human labor. So there's always a shortage. And this was the point where the Jews came in to Italy as money lenders. They had always been there, but they became really important figures. And basically the cultural artifact that talks about this is Shakespeare's play, The Merchant of Venice, which is about usury. It's about Jews and it's about usury. And it's about Christians trying to face up to this fact of how are we going to deal with this? How are we going to deal with this? So this is the moment where the money economy became important, that people needed money. They weren't being paid a decent wage, so they had to borrow money from the Jews.
Okay, hold on, Dr. Jones. We're going to take a break. We'll be back soon. Welcome back to Defense of Humanity. We're here tonight with Dr. Jones, who has a monthly magazine called Culture Wars, and he's got a wonderful website. We will put up a link so you can visit his website. There's a lot of wonderful information on it. He's done web podcasts he's posted, and he's done interviews. He's got some YouTubes there. I visited your website, Dr. Jones, and I was really, I could spend days there. You've got a lot of good information, a lot of good research. But I am very interested in helping people better understand the relationship between why we're being distracted by sex and that horrible little sitcom called Three Men and a Boy, it's filthy. Meanwhile, they're robbing us blind, and the people don't seem to understand we're losing representative government. There's nobody protecting us from the money monsters. Nobody protected us from the fraud closure, if everybody remembers. That is still ongoing. They are still stealing properties based on bogus, fraudulent mortgages. And yet, what do? We go watch TV or watch these outrageous movies, and we don't know what to do about it. That's what it seems like to me, Dr. Jones.
No, I agree with you completely. I've been around the world, and I've given a talk about sexual liberation and political control. And I began with an incident that happened in Ramallah, in the West Bank. The Israelis occupied it in 2002. The first thing they did was to take over the TV stations and start broadcasting pornography over the TV stations.
Oh, my gosh.
Now, you say to an audience, let's say to an American audience, well, what's pornography? What does that mean? And they would say, well, it's freedom, isn't it? I mean, there's even a movie that says this. It's called The People versus Larry Flynn. And basically, the premise of the movie is pornography is freedom, because the movie was made right at the time when the Clinton administration was trying to pass the Communications Decency Act, which meant communications indecency, by making sure pornography was available on the Internet. It was one of the biggest breakthroughs for the pornographers in history. So I said, if you think it's freedom, does this mean the Israelis want to bring freedom to the Palestinians? Well, no. Nobody could say that. So, well, why were they doing it? Well, because it's not freedom. It's the opposite of freedom. It's bondage.
Right.
It's an addiction. They wanted to, I gave the speech. I gave it once in Switzerland. I gave it once in Washington. And both of these instances, there were Palestinians there who came up to me and told me they were there in Ramallah when it happened. And he said, it's much worse than you said, because the Israelis put snipers on the roof of the hospital there, and they'd shoot anybody that came out into the street. So you had to stay inside, and your only source of news was information was the TV, and it was pornography. So they were forcing the Palestinians to watch pornography. Now, this wasn't in their interest. This wasn't to bring about freedom. This was just a crude form of what we've been subjected to ever since.
Yes. Well,
nobody's standing on the roof of the building, at least in Indiana here, and going to shoot me when I come out. But there's plenty of the pornography is now available in people's houses, which was not the case before. And this, it leads to a docile, self-absorbed, impotent population. And that's what they want. That's why it's there. So you can't protest the fact that things are bad and things are getting worse, and they're not being decided in your interest. They're being decided by the oligarchs for the oligarchs' interest. And as I said before, the main instrument of oligarchic power is usury.
And you know what kind of frustrates, you're absolutely right, and we say that all the time. What frustrates me, and that's why I'm so glad to have you on, is the number of people that I hear saying, well, the American people are stupid. As long as they're going to sit in front of their TV, they deserve what they get. I have a hard time convincing people that they've been victims of social engineering for their whole entire life. If you go back to that documentary I was talking about, Human Resources, what the goal was to unempower us. But the tragedy is the more unempowered we feel, the more we turn to addictive things, to, I call them band-aids, the more we're going to turn to sex. We're seeking some comfort in a world where we are debt slaves. Our creativity is squashed at every opportunity. So what do we have? We have hoarding. We have smoking. We have drinking. We have drugs. We have sex addiction. We have sports addiction. And people don't understand that all of these are traps that were put there on purpose.
That's right. You're absolutely right. I agree with you 100%. And I've written about this one way or the other, in various ways. The social engineering that was imposed, the Bible of social engineering was the American Dilemma, which was supposedly written by Gunnar Myrdal, the Swedish socialist. I cover this in my book, The Slaughter of Cities, Urban Renewal as Ethnic Cleansing. It's the story about the destruction of Catholic ethnic neighborhoods in the big cities all across the north and the eastern part of this country. But he said very clearly in this book, he uses the term social engineering, he said, there's no time in the history when social engineering has been more sought after than right now. We feel that we can solve every single problem. And after the war, there's going to be, after the end of World War II, there's going to be even more social engineering, and traditional freedoms like choosing where to live will no longer exist. Now, that's in the book. And after the war, that's precisely what happened. Two of the major forms of social engineering at that time were the car, leading to the suburb, and television. Yeah. And this occupied, you had to drive to work now. You couldn't live near where you worked anymore because you've been driven out of the cities into these settlements. And once you got home, you were there to watch television. And in a sense, the content was irrelevant. As long as you're being docile and watching television, that's the main thing. It was just entertainment to keep you from thinking other things. And the suburbs themselves, Levitt, the guy, the creator of Levittown, who learned how to do this working for the Seabees during World War II, he said, no man who has to mow his lawn will ever become a communist. He doesn't have time to become a communist because he's got to mow his lawn. So social engineering was programmed into all of these innovations after World War II, and it only got more draconian as time went on and more intrusive, and pornography being one of the big advances that has taken place, more and more sexual liberation, more and more intrusive social engineering into the private spheres of life, until finally we now have the homosexual as the avant-garde, and people are being forced to accept this and losing their political power because they can't object to it.
And now we have bathrooms that they want to have both sexes there. I mean, you probably saw the article about Target. So
yeah, I did.
We don't even have safety from a normal concept or a normal way of dealing with our body. We used to have restrooms that were all women, all men, and you know, it was a little respite. You could go in there, you feel safe, and you could do your hair and talk with your friends. Now they want to take that away.
Yeah. The point in North Carolina is, you know, you people think, well, don't they have anything better to do than talk about where to go to the bathroom? No, this is imposed on them. because it's a way of overturning representative government in the state of North Carolina. It's a way of showing those legislatures that they have no power unless it is granted to them by the oligarchs, namely the CEOs, the homosexuals, and the Jews who are supporting homosexual marriage.
And social change.
That's right.
And actually, cultural destruction. I mean, you call it culture wars. It, to me, it looks like a cultural destruction of a society that functions very well within the family construct.
Well, the family builds independent people, and that's precisely what they don't want. They want docile people that can be influenced by the media that they control. That's the whole point of this.
So it's a war against the family as well.
Well, yeah, because, as I said, the family builds people who have some type of critical thinking and independence, because they are, in a sense, even with all this intrusion, they are outside of the control mechanism of the state. And that's why the family has to be subverted.
Well, also, among all of this social engineering, it appears to me they've gone out of their way to create consumerism.
Yes. Well, here they're in a bind, okay? Yeah, you can talk about consumerism, but you can't have consumerism and debt for any period of time, okay? So the first wave, okay, we'll have the credit card, and you can go out and buy something you can't really afford. Well, there's a kind of rush. It's like the first shot of heroin you take for the, and the economy gets this kind of rush. But over the haul, over the long haul, what you have is a lot of people in debt.
Right.
And so all of the money that they have is being used to service the debt. Well, guess what? That's the end of consumerism. You can't buy anything anymore because the debt has gotten so big that it's strangling the economy. That's the problem right now.
And people have maxed out their credit cards now where they're all facing, they're facing bankruptcies. Their jobs have been exported. Unemployment is outrageously high. How can they pay their debt? How can they pay their payments when they're unemployed?
Well, now you're exposing the irrationality of usury, because it basically kills the host. I mean, this is Michael Hudson's latest book called Killing the Host, where he talks about the whole world being burdened with debt, unrepayable debt. But that's precisely the irrationality. So you've got a group of people, let's just say the creditors at this point, who have their hands on the steering wheel. They're driving the car off the cliff, and nobody can seem to pry their hands off the steering wheel. That's the problem we have now, not just in the state legislature battle, but in the presidential primary too, where what you have is pretty much two oligarch parties and no party representing the people. So you end up with protest votes like in New Hampshire, where the people voted for Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump because they're perceived as anti-oligarch, anti-establishment candidates.
Right. Well, I am, it's just looking pretty grim for most families now. I mean, I do know people who are unemployed. Statistics, I was talking to John Stadmiller about this on his show yesterday. You know, I said, Shadow Stats, John Williams is reporting that our unemployment rate is 22, and John corrected me, 22%, and he said it's closer to 30-something percent. Well, how in the name of Hannah can we function when these people don't have employment, they don't have income? I know they're on food stamps, but you know what? If you're on Medicaid and food stamps, you're under their control completely.
Yeah. The people in their 20s are the people who are most affected by this. I went to the Occupy Wall Street demonstration, and I walked through the crowds there, and it was, in spite of what they were saying on Fox News, it was mostly people in their 20s, and they were all holding little cards that said, I'm $50,000 in debt, and all I can get is an unpaid internship. This is a recipe for economic disaster.
It is.
You can't load people down with debt and promise them something, a job that they're never going to get. The economy is going to die. No one seems to be. So what was the reaction? The FBI sides with the oligarchs, and they treat these kids who they seem like American citizens to me. Why is the FBI siding with the oligarchs here? Why did they use this power to break up this demonstration where I think people, young people, had what I consider a legitimate grievance? Well, I guess because the government's run by the oligarchs and in their interest. I think that's the conclusion you have to come to, and I think there's widespread dissatisfaction now. The level of consciousness has never been higher, I don't think, about the real parameters of our government here. That the whole idea of democracy is a facade, and the only reason people are called to vote is to ratify the agenda of the oligarchs. That's becoming obvious to large numbers of people now.
Yeah, well, and there's other reasons. We've talked about that on previous shows, but you're right. As long as the people go vote, and we've talked about how important it is not to vote, because as long as you vote, you are counted on the list of those who still have faith in the system. As long as they get people to vote, they say, well, look, we've got the people still supporting this system because they went to the booth and they voted. When nobody votes, then they'll all of a sudden realize that nobody supports them anymore. But
well, we're close to that point in South Bend, Indiana. I mean, in the off-year election, 7% show up at the polls.
That's amazing.
And they're never so the latest election that the mayor announced he's a homosexual. So this makes his election for a second term a ratification of his homosexuality. The newspaper says 80%, he got 80% of the vote. Well, what they forgot to tell you is that only 11% of the people showed up.
So,
if you held this in Bosnia, if the United Nations held this election in Bosnia, it wouldn't be valid.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, if they control the media, they've got people believing anything. I mean, I scream at the TV. We turn it on and I listen to them. My husband's got a theory. We have to know what the enemy is saying. And I walk through the room and I listen to what the enemy is saying and I just start screaming. You know, I just say, I think this is polluting our brain. You should turn it off. This is called mind pollution. And I said, I don't want to listen to it anymore. They're all lying. And people
don't see it. I think we have opportunities now. I think the consciousness is rising, and in a sense, it's our job to help it, focus it, and explain what's going on. I'll just give you one instance. The ADL just condemned Donald Trump for using the term America First, and they said it's anti-Semitic to use the term America First.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, my gosh.
So I think that moments like that are educational moments. I think that what we're seeing here when something like happens is that the real system is emerging before us. So what that means is basically the term anti-Semite is not really what it says. It's a form of control. I mean, my late friend Joe Sobrin used to say an anti-Semite used to be someone who didn't like Jews. Now it's someone Jews don't like.
That's so true.
This is an example of that. Now, how many people are going to take that lying down? I don't know. I don't know, but I think there's a moment, an educational moment right there, that I think we should have the courage to explicate for everyone. This is control. This is not about hurting Jews or anything like that. It's all a form of control, controlling the thought of the people, telling someone what he's allowed to think and what he's not allowed to think. Right. Well, who gave them this power?
Well, and now they're taking it further. I'm sure you followed this story. Now they want to decide what we can ingest and what medicine we must take. In other words, they've gone beyond just polluting our mind. Now they want to take control of our physical bodies by forcing drugs on us, by forcing toxic water on us, by forcing toxic food on us. Now it appears to me, and we have had a show on that, now they are moving to reduce the population, but they want us to ingest this freely. In other words, they want us to say, it's okay if you poison me. I'm okay with that. And, I mean, it sickens you when you know the truth about what they're doing with the food and the medication and the vaccines, and they're lying to the public every day saying this is for your health. when actually they're degrading our health.
Yep, yep.
And they're doing it on a massive scale. So part of the culture war isn't part of the culture war to convince us that what is bad for us is good for us?
Well, that what is good for us is what they say is good for us. In other words, we should operate in their interest and not in our own. That's right. That's the essence. The media are so powerful that they feel they can do anything. They can tell you that a man is a woman now, or a woman is a man.
Right.
In other words, there's no essence anymore. This is sort of the heart of the matter. Do we have an essence? Is there being? Is there a real essence to being a male or a female, or to being a human being, or to being anything? And their answer is no. And the proof is Bruce Jenner, I guess. I guess that's the proof, isn't it? Well, that a male can go and mutilate himself and shoot himself up with all kinds of drugs. And because he does that, he will call himself a woman, and the media will ratify that statement and force us to agree with it.
Right. And of course, I think you understand that underlying that is this concept that they'd like us to buy into, that is, you're not okay. In other words, I was raised to believe being a female was a wonderful thing. I should be happy about it. My brothers were raised to believe that being a male was a wonderful thing. We were never raised to believe that the color of our skin or our sexuality was a problem. We were raised to believe it was like a blessing.
Right.
Feel good about who you are. You're fine. There's nothing wrong with you. You were created from this wonderful, you know, source of life, and here you are, and we're happy to have you. I mean,
yeah.
Isn't that what they're trying to undermine?
Yeah, well, yeah, of course they are. But what is the opposite of all that? What is that? They're saying will is supreme. The will. They give you the illusion that your will is more powerful than nature. But what they're really saying is that their will is more powerful, and you're just deluding yourself. But what's the opposite of will? The opposite of will is logos, is reason. And what we're saying is that there's an order to the universe that was placed there by God. And what our job is to discover what it is.
Yes.
And to conform our minds to God's plan. That's what Logos is. That's the essence of Logos.
And isn't Logos also, you know, you and I were going to talk more about that because I'm fascinated with the idea. But doesn't it include our creativity, allowing us to... encouraging and part of who we are? Is it not creating music, creating art, creating song, creating poetry? I mean, is not our creativity a part of Logos?
Sure. Sure. There is, I mean, if there is a Logos to music, there's an order to it. That's why you feel satisfaction when you listen to music, to real music.
Right.
Because it starts out and creates an emotion. There's a tension that builds up in the music, and you start to see there's something going to happen, and then it resolves it back to where you were at the beginning. You feel as if you've been through something. The Greeks used to call this catharsis. You felt better. Catharsis is a medical term. Aristotle was a physician, and he understood that human beings felt better when there was something that ratified the sense of logos that they had. That's what we're talking about here.
What is the word joy, Dr. Jones? Is that not part of it as well?
Joy?
Yes.
Yeah. What I think we're talking about here is beauty.
Yes.
What is beauty is traditionally defined as the splendor of the truth. And so when you suddenly have this burst of both reality and understanding in one object, you're struck by its beauty.
Yes.
And I think that's the reason we go and look and we feel good after having seen or listened to a great piece of music or watched a beautiful piece of art or something like that. It's a combination of existence and essence all in one thing at one burst, and that burst is what we feel beauty, and beauty gives us joy.
And I think I always call it makes your heart sing. I don't know if that's kind of primitive, but you see it in little children when they do a happy dance, and all of a sudden they're just bubbling over with happiness. And it seems to be in every child goes through that, and there they are. There's their spirit, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I visit people up in Michigan, and they all have big families. You know, there are lots of kids there with these families. And at one point I said, I play Irish music every Monday night here in South Bend. And I said, you should take up Irish music. And I went back, and they actually did it. And there are all these kids, like four-year-olds, playing the tin whistle. It shows you how receptive they are to the logos of music. They understand. They couldn't tell you at all what they're doing. They could never explain to you what they were doing or why it was significant, but they actually can do it.
Right.
They understand that there's an order to this music, that it's kind of fulfilling to be able to represent, to reproduce that order, and they just take to it like ducks to water.
And the same thing with dance. Have you noticed? The same thing with dance. Children enjoy moving their bodies to dance and to music, and I don't believe it's taught. I think it's natural.
Well, it's part of it's the way you are. And what so to get back here, you're exposed. I was a guinea pig in a social engineering experiment for my entire life, and I started to wake up to it, and then I started to realize that there's a certain group that keeps promoting subversion of this, and I noticed it in American foreign policy, the whole Iraq war, the neoconservatives got us into this war, and I started to look into it in a systematic way, and that's why I wrote The Jewish Revolutionary Spirit, to examine the Jewish participation in cultural subversion that's been going, cultural subversion and revolution that's been going on for centuries. And I traced it all the way back to the crucifixion of Jesus Christ.
Wow.
Jesus Christ was the Logos incarnate. St. John, the Gospel of St. John begins, in arche ein ha Logos. In the beginning there was Logos. And then he says, kai Logos ein Theos. And Logos was God. So he was the Logos incarnate, the embodiment of that, all of the entire, of the rationality of the entire universe. And the Jews had been expecting a Messiah, and the Messiah arrived, and they had to make up their minds about whether they're going to accept him on his terms or on their terms. And the majority decided to reject him because he didn't promise worldly power and riches. Now, when they rejected Jesus Christ, they rejected Logos. And when you reject Logos, you're rejecting the order of the universe. And when you reject the order of the universe, you become a revolutionary. And that's what the Jews have been ever since. That's what they are today. So if I say the Jews are behind gay marriage, people will accuse me of being an anti-Semite. But what I'm really saying, I'm quoting the Jew himself, her, in this case herself. Amy Dean, a Jewish lady, wrote in Tikkun magazine, Jewish magazine, that if it weren't for the Jews, there would be no such thing as gay marriage. Now, how is it that she can say it and expect applause from the audience, but when I say it, I'm called an anti-Semite and people should shun me?
Yep. Okay, hold on, Dr. Jones. On that note, we're going to take a break. We'll be back in several minutes. I'm Al Whitney. I'm here with Dr. Michael Jones. During the break, I was telling Dr. Jones, and he and I concurred that a lot of our addictions, our weaknesses, hoarding, all of the things that they blame us for being weak. They blame us. Oh, and they even claim that we have a biological affinity to addiction. It's always blamed on the victim, isn't it, Dr. Jones? I mean,
yes.
They strip us of our empowerment. They do everything they can to beat us down. And then they blame us for being imperfect, right?
That's right. Blame the victim.
This is something they've done for centuries, isn't it?
Well, if that's the case, it has certainly increased lately. Because you create a weakness, then there's always an industry that will help deal with the weakness. So the regime is always the arsonist and the fire department at the same time. You know, they create just recently this whole resurrection of the race issue. Where did the race issue come from? I mean, there was a time of 70 years. I cover this in the book, The Jewish Revolutionary Spirit, the creation of the Black Jewish Alliance, which began with the NAACP in 1913. No, after that, around that time. But I mean, in reaction first of all, the B'nai B'rith was created in reaction to the Leo Frank case, the hanging of Leo Frank.
Yeah.
And then you have the NAACP, which is basically a Jewish organization that tried to turn black people down south into revolutionaries. Marcus Garvey showed up. It was at NAACP headquarters. Marcus Garvey, the great black nationalist, showed up at NAACP headquarters in New York. Couldn't see a black person at all. It was all Jewish lawyers run by the Spingarn brothers. The culmination of that was the civil rights movement, which was basically a revolution down south. The whole thing collapsed in 1967 when Harold Cruz wrote The Crisis of the Negro Intellectual and told what it was like to be a black person in the Communist Party being ordered around by Jews for their interest. So it kind of collapsed. The homosexual rose as the new proxy warrior in the Cultural Revolution. That's in many ways the main thing today. But all of a sudden, out of the blue, the Black Jewish Alliance got resurrected with Black Lives Matter and the Ferguson riots and also the coup d'etat at University of Missouri.
Yep.
This was all orchestrated by George Soros.
Yep.
George Soros spent $33 million to get this thing back going again.
Oh my gosh. Okay, can we take some calls now? Okay, Nancy from California. Good evening.
Hello.
Yes, good evening, Nancy.
I did not hear your introduction when you began your program. What is Dr. Jones's first name?
His name is Dr. E. Michael Jones, and he is an author. He's written wonderful books. He's prolific, really, a prolific writer and researcher. He's a mountain of information. I've spent all day on his website listening to his podcasts and reading
his information. So the book you just mentioned.
Okay, and his website is www.culturewars.com. Correct, Dr. Jones?
Yes, that's it.
And he's a professor. Maybe you could tell her a little bit more. You've been researching this for how many years?
Well, and I had another question. After I hear that, I don't hang up because I've got one more question after that.
Okay, no problem. Dr. Jones, how many years have you been involved in all this?
I started it. I'm not a professor. I used to be a professor.
Okay.
I got fired from a Catholic college for opposing abortion in 1980, and in 1981 I started what is now Culture Wars magazine. So I've been doing it for 35 years now.
Wow.
So
and
you were... What happened What happened because you opposed abortion?
I got fired. St.
Oh,
Mary's College,
goodness, from
South Bend, Indiana. I got fired in 1980 because I opposed abortion.
Wow. In the land of the free, home of the brave.
Wow. And how many books have you written?
Well, now we have e-books, so it's hard to... I say somewhere around 30 if you count the e-books.
Oh, my gosh. You're just a mountain. We'll have to have you on again because the information you have is invaluable. Okay, Nancy, I'm sorry. We're not going to let you go. What question
did
you have? What question did you have?
So my question is, you mentioned that woman who said that if it weren't for the Jews, there wouldn't be any homosexual marriage. What was her name?
Amy Dean. D-E-A-N.
So A-M-Y.
A-M-Y, first name, and the D-E-A-N is the second name, and the magazine is called Tikkun, T-I-K-K-U-N. So if you type that, and maybe if you type in that and Obergefell, which was the Supreme Court decision, you'll get the article.
Okay, can you spell Oka? What was it called?
Obergefell is O-B-E-R-G-E-F-E-L. That's the Supreme Court decision that she was commenting on. That's the Supreme Court decision that allowed gay marriage.
Okay. Excellent resource. I really appreciate that. I Googled it and couldn't find anything, so I appreciate you filling me in. Thank you.
Yeah, it's Amy Dean Tikkun Magazine.
Okay. Thank you.
Is that it, Nancy? Bye-bye. Thank you for calling in, Nancy. Okay, we have Wes from Idaho, I believe, and he's back. Wes, good evening.
Rick, I'm back. Yeah, question for Dr. Jones. He probably knows Professor Unwin of Cambridge and Oxford and the book Sex and Culture from 1934. Also, a little spot on YouTube, 18 minutes long by Black Pigeon. It's got a 500,000 views now, 82% approval. Al, please don't take this too personally, but anyway, the title of this video is Why Women Destroy Nations and Cultures. Could I get a comment on either one of those two from you, Mr. Jones?
No, sorry, not familiar with either one.
Really?
No.
Well, I'll put it shortly, and it has to do with women, their passions being given unbridled control. Professor of Cambridge and Oxford, came to basically the same conclusions that you are, Mr. Jones, that when you have Lady Gaga and Madonna and such things, that the culture goes downhill with that. Anyway, that's my comment, and you might want to check those two things out. It's on YouTube, and Professor Unwin, his book is on the internet. You can't actually buy a copy. I tried to buy a copy. I got a copy from Liberty University Law Library. The doggone thing, I guess, had never been read because 62 of the pages were still not glued together but not cut properly at manufacturing, so I had to send it back. But anyway, thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome. There's one thing I would like to say here.
Sure.
This is not a new idea. Euripides wrote a play called The Bacchae, or The Bacchant Women. This is about the god Dionysus. The Asiatic god Dionysus comes to Thebes. And when the god of intoxication and sexual excess comes to Thebes, the women all leave their looms and go off, and they start dancing naked on the mountainside. The king, Pentheus, decides he has to take this in hand. He captures Dionysus. He says, now you're my prisoner. And then Dionysus, instead of answering him, says, would you like to see the women dance naked on the mountainside? He says, yes. So he goes up there, has to put on a dress to get there, climbs a tree. The women see him, and they tear him limb from limb. Now, this is the story, the warning that Euripides is giving the world about what will happen if you unleash the sexual passion. In other words, once you take it out of the home, once you take it out of marriage, once you take it out of the family, once you liberate it, it's an incredibly destructive force, and it will destroy society. Now, this was at the time of Plato and Aristotle, okay? It's not a new idea, okay? It got put into effect in Europe and America, and the effect has been the destruction of society. Now, that's not the end of the story, because no one's going to allow the society to be destroyed. What happens when the social structures are destroyed is the tyrant, what Plato would call the tyrant, or what we would call the oligarch, comes in and restructures it according to his principles. That's the world we live in right now.
Right. And their principles are our actions and our activities should serve them.
That's right. That is the fundamental. That's what St. Augustine meant by libido dominandi.
Yes.
Which is the title of my book on sexual liberation and political control. The dominating urge, the dominating desire. It's the antithesis of Christianity. Christians are taught to love and serve their neighbor. The opposite of Christianity is to dominate your neighbor for your benefit. I said it before, it's like the difference between Christ and Dracula. Jesus Christ shed his blood so that you can have eternal life. Dracula sheds your blood so that he can have eternal life. That's the choice we have right now.
And I honestly, this whole thing about pedophilia, there are many people, and we haven't talked about that, Dr. Jones, there are many people who think there is a movement afoot to make pedophilia normal and accepted in our society. That just outrages me. Are you familiar with, do you think there is such a movement afoot?
The movement is to break down all sense of moral order, because that's the only thing that protects us from the powerful. That's the only defense we have against the rich and the powerful, and they know that, and they want to break it down so they have total control over us. Our only defense is the moral order, and the only defense we have there is our Logos, and Jesus Christ is the Logos incarnate, and that's why Christian societies are free.
Well, and all of Christian societies that I know, okay, and I, of course, I don't know all cultures, but every culture that I know, protecting the children, nurturing the children, protecting the children, caring for other children, that is part of what humans do.
Right.
And right. It's a critically important part of what we do.
If you're going to liberate people from responsibilities like this, it's another word for enslaving them. That's all you're doing. You can't be liberated from reason because you're a rational creature. If you liberate yourself from reason, you become the slave of either the passions or other people who manipulate your passions.
Oh, my gosh. Well, we're going to a break. Dr. Jones, I think you have to go. I thank you so much for being on the show. Will you come back in the future again?
I'd be happy to.
Okay, great. You've got great information. I really encourage everyone to go to his website. Well, you're going to spend days there. And he's right on track, and he's on our side. Yay. Thank you. We'll be back after this break.